Hello, and welcome to episode 234 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
You recently shared with me a column by Philip Bump of the Washington Post, in which he reflected on when he and others joined AmeriCorps in the late 1990s, a moment of national optimism when public service felt like part of a larger civic renewal. A quarter century later, many of them still care deeply about their communities, but they describe their idealism as more world-weary, less glossy, and more pragmatic. And let's be honest, that feels a little familiar. Most of us probably thought differently in our 20s than we do now. We believed institutions could be reshaped. We believed empathy was a civic strength. We believed big problems had solutions if people just worked hard enough. Then life complicates things. Systems are harder to move than we imagined. Trade-offs are real. And experience tempers certainty. I don't consider myself to be especially idealistic, and I think I've probably become more pragmatic as I've gotten older. And I actually think that's a good thing. But it does raise a deeper question. So, Rick, let's start here. Is idealism something we outgrow as we mature, or is it a moral stance we can't afford to lose?
Well, we often say that young people tend to be more idealistic and then they outgrow it as they have negative experiences in life, or say as they join a protest movement and they find that like nothing changes, you know, after they've been out protesting something that they consider to be an injustice. But I think that most people do outgrow that a kind of naive, youthful enthusiasm and a kind of thinking that the world can change easily, or we can easily reshape institutions, or even our own lives sometimes. We have a kind of idealism, often when we're young, about our own lives and what we're able to achieve. That sometimes results in cynicism, like people just say, like, nothing changes. We can't do anything about the problems in the world. Sometimes, however, people become more determined, like they become more strategically engaged to make changes. And I would still call that a kind of idealism. And that's why I consider myself to be an idealist. I don't think I'm naive about the prospects for changing things. I just think we should be determined to change things.
One thing really jumped out at me at what you just said is you said when people are younger, maybe when we were both younger, we thought the world would be easy to change and we realized it wasn't. However, I don't think in the 30 years, I'll pick a number, that that has traced our lives generally from young adults to where we are now, the world has changed dramatically. I mean, I don't know that there is a 30-year stretch in world history, maybe, that the world's changed as quickly as it has. So I don't think I quite agree that the fact that we're just in sort of this period of stasis where nothing really happens and we can't affect change because the world's just stuck. It's changed a lot. So, I mean, is it because of idealism maybe that has propelled us to where we are? And again, there's a whole separate argument to be made about whether we're in a better place than we are or whether where we were. But like, is there some segment of idealists that sort of won this, or is that just the wrong way to look at this?
I think what happens is we teach children a kind of naive idealism. We say, like, if you dream it, you can achieve it.
You can be anything
you want to be. Build it and they will come. We have all these phrases that encourage a certain kind of naive optimism about the prospects, not just for change overall, but your ability to affect change, right, on your own timeline. And it's a kind of naive optimism is what it is. And I don't think that's healthy. Now, so I agree with you completely that we've seen incredible changes over a lifetime. But what I've What I've seen is at the same time that there's been incredible positive changes, like we've talked a lot about this, the reduction in poverty, the extension of our lifespans, you know, all these
looking at worldwide statistics, yes.
Yeah, really good. And yet, like when we were young, we were taught, for example, that Rosa Parks, like she's fed up with injustices. She's going to refuse to get off the bus. And this starts, you know, the civil rights movement. But we aren't told that for years she's part of a group that planned strategically, how are they going to fight injustice in their communities? That's what I mean by a kind of naive optimism about how change takes place. You can't become anything you dream about, but you can become a lot of things that you plan and prepare for. That's a problem where I think like there's a kind of naivete that we often overcome. And if we have the wrong expectations, it's going to result in cynicism, and that's bad for all of us.
And you mentioned a couple of times that optimism is probably necessary, I suppose, for idealism. Is that true, though? Because I think if, like, we lived in something close to a utopian world, I mean, whether that exists, I don't know, but, like, there would not be these large clamorings for how to make things better. We've sort of, like, done it all. But if you live in a world that's closer to reality like ours, where there's lots of ways we can be better, well, then it requires idealists in some ways to, like, look ahead and say, how can we make things better? It just seems like those people would have this idealism rooted in sort of a pessimism that we're sort of in a bad place today. And I guess I'm just trying to maybe ask in an awkward way, why do you think idealists can be optimistic? Because clearly they look and see clearly, at least through their eyes, all the problems that exist.
I want to distinguish between hope and optimism.
Okay, that's probably a good point.
Yeah, two possible attitudes we can take. Hope is the conviction that things are going to work out for the good. Optimism is a thought that things are going to turn out in this particular way, according to some kind of strategy. For example, the Wall Street protests. You remember the Wall Street protests?
Occupy
Wall Street. Like, there was a lot of, I think, optimists there thinking, like, we're going to make changes and we're going to reform America's economic system.
And we're the start of a movement.
And then nothing happens. In fact, there's a pretty popular reaction against it, right? I think the same thing happened with the campus protests about Palestine and Israel a couple of years ago. That's a kind of optimism that I think often it gets frustrated and turns to cynicism later. I think a genuine idealist is grounded in hope. That is, there's some ideal that we want to move toward. There's a goal that's really hard to achieve but worth achieving. And there's a conviction that if enough of us work together to achieve this, we're going to be able to achieve it. It just might not be on our own timeline or in the particular way that we foresee. We just think that, like, it's worth achieving, and so we're going to keep striving towards it.
And it also seems like the most successful idealists, there are probably some who are more successful than others, realize that you have to work together. I mean, the example you gave at the start of the show about how Rosa Parks was not some disgruntled woman who decided she was fed up with something. She was part of a larger group, and there was a strategy there. And I think there is sort of a strength in community where you find people who have these same idealistic goals that you do. I guess I think you agree with that, but maybe the question is, why does that seem so popular, or why do you find that so much among young people? Is it just because they're starting out and looking ahead and trying to make their lives better? Is it because they might have more time on their hands than other people? Why do you think a lot of those grassroots movements start with those who are, I'll say, college age to young adults?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of those things. I think it's time. There's no world weariness that has settled in often yet. There's much more openness to possibilities of change. So it's all of those things. And like the world still seems fresh and new. When you're young, you just have more energy.
Yeah.
You have a lot more energy to devote to things like that. And so, and there's good and bad things about that. I mean, the good is that you bring the energy. The bad can be that you can have unrealistic expectations for how much we can achieve at any moment. And so you get impatient with the kind of incremental progress of change that, like, and most really positive change in society is incremental. It's not all like change that tends to happen very rapidly is often also destructive because so many people that don't have the resources to navigate the huge disruptions of massive social change kind of fall by the wayside. And so really positive and long-lasting change tends to be incremental. And what I would say is seasoned idealists know that. They know that we're talking about a journey, not just one leg of the journey, one trip.
You mentioned, you know, one of the reasons this may be something seen more widely in young people is they're not as world weary, is the phrase you used. And as I was thinking about today's show, I was thinking about, like, what's the opposite of being an idealist? And the one word I may have come up with was pragmatist. And I don't think idealists are all bad or all good, and I don't think pragmatists are all bad or all good. But is that maybe a good way to frame this up? Is that sort of the not only the opposite of being an idealist, but also what world weariness sometimes can be turned into, is being more pragmatic and saying, well, this is the world the way it is, and I need to, instead of fight against the system, either adjust to the system or try to find my place within it.
I think you share what most people would say, that the opposite of idealism is either pragmatism or realism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think pragmatism and realism are often lumped together. I would say that pragmatism and idealism work hand in hand. I think idealism is about the goal. Pragmatism is the means for getting to a goal. So pragmatism just means that you employ practical means to get somewhere. It doesn't say that you can't achieve a goal. It's just like you're realistic about the methods that have to be used, the means that have to be used to get to the goal. So I would say the opposite of idealism is cynicism, where you just say, like, there's no point to it. It's rigged. It's like the whole system's corrupt. You can't do anything about it. We're finding, for example, right now, we're finding, especially with young men, record numbers of young men that are gambling and that think that there's no way for them to get out of debt or get any ahead except by taking these long shot chances.
Either gambling or crypto or sort of that very non-traditional path to success.
Yeah. And I would say that that's an expression of cynicism. It's not pragmatism. It's, you know, like, the most pragmatic way to get out of debt is to do it incrementally over a long time and to make a plan. And then to make a plan to, how am I going to earn something? How am I going to increase my prospects so I gradually earn more as I go on in life? And then how do I set enough aside to gradually pay off this debt? That's pragmatic. I think it's often also idealistic in saying, yeah, I can actually achieve that kind of goal. So this is being an idealist towards your own life. I mean, I think it's the only way to live. But to say, like, the only chance I have is some kind of long shot, you know, and so I'm just going to, whatever wages I have, I'm just going to bet them on something with DraftKings or something and, like, hope I hit one of these long shots. That's cynicism. That's like, I've given up on my life. That's how I would contrast the two.
And also, we talked a minute ago about how successful idealists realize they have to work together as a community to get things done. And there are not many people who are running crypto schemes or people who are trying to pick the over. I'm trying to use gambling terms. I don't know, so forgive me. But like the over and under, the, you know, some parlay. I think that's something people talk about when they're betting on sports. I mean, that's not some collective, in most cases, some group activity. These are people, you know, who are alone and often isolated from the rest of society and their peer group. And I know you think that's not healthy at all.
No, the people that are working together are the people who are running the gambling company.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
They're working together and they're being strategic and they're not gambling, right? They're working on a strategic way to take money out of the pockets of all these young people. That's what they're doing. I think this is what happens when a society gives up on idealism. It allows predatory practices like this to exist, to rob people of their hope. I think we need meaningful student debt relief. I really hate what the Biden administration did, and I think it really set us back a long time by pursuing unconstitutional means of extending debt relief to some students but not others and do it without congressional passage. I think that then just became dead as something that American people really wanted to get behind.
And it was a red versus blue issue at that point.
Yeah, it became entirely partisan. We need real focus as a society. What do we do to relieve young people of really crippling debt? And then we need to have regulatory laws limiting access to gambling, because it's like it's destroying an entire generation. And so when, as a society, we give up an idealism, we say, like, either like our future generation isn't worth saving, or there's nothing we can do about it. This is what happens.
I want to go back to something we talked about it kind of at the start of the show. I don't have kids. You did, but, and I don't know if you gave your kids this message, but I remember hearing this from my mother, especially when I was young, is the whole phrase of, you know, you can do anything you set your mind to. There's no limitations about what you can do. And I guess that aspirational stuff is good, right? But, and if you would have asked me, like, when I was, you know, 12 years old, I might have thought, when I grow up, I want to be the starting third baseman for the New York Yankees. And, you know, and you have all, and I'd like to make, you know, well, at the time, $1 million a year seemed like a lot of money, and all these, like, aspirational things. And as we grow older, I quickly realize that I do not have even close to the skill set to become the third baseman for the New York Yankees. And there's all sorts of things that, as we mature, even into our late teens, we realize that all these, you know, maybe unrealistic dreams we had about how our life might be, at least in my case, I'm certainly happy with my life, but I'm not some multi-million dollar superstar person. And I guess, is that kind of overlay this whole process that, like, humans go through of, like, starting off thinking your life's going to be great, and then, like, and the word that just I kept coming back to was settling. Like, you're not working at the most prestigious university in the history of America. I have not won a closet full of Pulitzer Prizes. I mean, we are not the top most people in our professions, and we're probably fine with that. I think you're happy with what you do and where you're at, and so am I. But does that mean we've sort of settled for what we are? Because I don't feel like that's the case, but I just wonder, in trying to wrap this in our topic of idealism, I just wonder that if that's, like, part of the process of growing up is that, yeah, I'm not going to be the journalist who is breaking the next Watergate, but I'm fine with that. And I guess is that sort of like just sort of the progress we have? Am I explaining that well?
Yeah. In some ways, I mean, as we go on in life, we do have experiences that kind of shape what our range of expectations can be. And I think it's important to have realistic expectations. I think we should also set some pretty high expectations. But the high expectations have to be high expectations about, like, how much effort can I give? Like, how much can I expect from myself to work towards something? And not like what is the end result going to be, which is largely out of my control. And I this is one of the things I'm like really grateful to my parents for, is they never encouraged me to set high expectations for achievement. They always had high expectations for effort. They always wanted me to work hard. They wanted me to do my best. They wanted me to develop what skills. They wanted like find out what skills I have and then develop them. They really encouraged those things. I think that's an appropriate kind of high expectation. And when we set children up for high expectation for certain kinds of results, or what kind of recognition society is going to give them, what kind of awards, like you're going to be the person who wins like first place in the Pinewood Derby, like that just like you have no control over that. And so I think that that's wrong. And I think it's damaging to kids.
And I just worry that, you know, you sort of as a kid realize that all these probably unrealistic dreams that you had about yourself, as you realize they don't come true. I just worry that that may be a cascade at times that, well, and then I won't be able to accomplish this. And I guess I won't be able to accomplish this after all. So I'm going to have to settle for like not a normal happy life, but that's even somehow out of reach. And it just sort of. That the idealism is quickly stripped away because you have realized as growing up that all these hopes and dreams you once had just seem unobtainable. And I don't know, maybe I'm making this into a bigger arc of life discussion than I should, but I do wonder sometimes that if there is just like a period of time in all of our, in many people's lives, where you go from being idealistic to pragmatic to maybe even skeptical and cynical, because all these things that you once believed just don't seem true. And maybe the question there is, if even a sliver of that rings true to you, like, how do you set people up more for success and ground people more in a hopeful reality versus these like things that probably will just never come true?
That's real tricky. I think it's a matter of having expectations that are largely in line with what's capable for your sphere of influence. And we shouldn't expect the world to immediately reward us on our own terms. Like I can work really hard at something. I don't know what the world is going to say about it, but that doesn't affect how hard and how hard I work at it and what kind of effort I put in.
And maybe how you feel about it.
Exactly. And I shouldn't take my cue to how I should feel about it based on how the world recognizes it. So like what I make as far as, you know, my salary, that's not an estimation of my worth as either a person or as a writer or a thinker, a teacher, like those sorts of things. That's kind of accidental. That's something that happens, and I maybe have a little bit of influence over that, but not a lot.
And you like probably earn less money every year than Elon Musk, am I right?
Yeah.
But are you like, and as I mean,
for most of my career, I was earning less than the average of my graduates. I was teaching at small Catholic universities where, you know, like low salary, and I was grateful for the opportunity to continually work on my craft and develop the kind of craft that I really wanted to focus on and really wanted to develop, and so. That was my expectation. You know, the other thing I find, like people, because I've written a few books, people take that as like this big achievement. I have never regarded it that way. You know, like for me, an achievement is like if I can write a really good sentence, if I can write a good paragraph, or I can, you know, like when I work on a column, every time it's a struggle. I think, you know, I've written hundreds of columns now. Every time I think, like, I've got no ideas, I'm not going to be able to get this done, I'm not focusing on, like, what people are going to say about it afterwards. I'm really focused on, I'm trying to like express something, get some thoughts down, and there's no guarantee it's going to be able to happen this time. I'm an idealist in that regard. Like I have confidence that it's going to be work out. I just don't, like, I'm struggling to write a column on idealism right now. And I've been working out for several days. I can't get it to work out. And I'm incredibly frustrated right now in writing about this, but I'm not going to give up on it. And I don't think I'm going to win any prizes or I'm necessarily going to press anybody else. I'm just trying to think, like, how do I think about this topic clearly and write something that makes sense? And that's what my goal is.
You said earlier that you firmly believe the opposite of idealism is not pragmatism, but is cynicism. I think that's probably right. But is cynicism, like, always bad? I mean, are there times where you can look at the world around you, whether it's your life or like literally the world around you, and have a cynical view of it? Is that like sometimes ever an ethical way to look at life?
Cynicism is always bad. It's always a giving up, and it's an attitude that goes really deep, and it's a rejection of the goodness in life, of the goodness in the future. Let me tell a story. I'd come across a couple essays by somebody that he had talked about organizational management, but he had come up with some ideas that I thought were really helpful that I'd been sharing with students and so forth. But they were like 20 years old, and I was wondering if he'd written any more, so forth. So I found out like where he taught. I called him up. This was like 15, 20 years ago. I called him up. He answered the phone, and I said, you know, I really love this essay that you wrote. I've been using it, and I wonder if you've written any more. And he said, oh, are you still hopeful that things can change? And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, you're teaching leadership. Do you think it does any good? And I said, well, yeah, I know it does some good. This is the feedback I'm getting from people. He says, I used to think so too. But I've been at this now for 40 years and it's all a crock. Nothing good comes of it. I was really shocked. Here's somebody who, what he had been writing wasn't just an expression of, I thought, kind of a naive kind of optimism about the world or the prospects for change. I think what had happened in the meantime, like he'd been working with some organizations and there was some pretty significant corruption. And like he'd been working with them and then everything fell apart. I think that happens pretty often. This happens with organizations because you get changes in people and people will lie to you. And like this, that's just the conditions we work in. I think this is part of my Christian background. I think we live in a world full of sin where people will do devious and cruel things to one another. And I think that infects our organizations and our communities. I still think it's worth pushing against that, trying to lift people up and make them better and make our communities better. I really felt bad for him because he had become a cynic, and I could maybe understand how that had happened, but I never think it's a good thing.
I would agree with that. The only thing that I walk away from hearing that story, and also from what we talked about earlier, how it's quite a common path for people to start out young and idealistic and end up closer to where this person was 30 years later. And the thing that's discouraging to me about hearing stories like that is that I would really hope that as all of us age, and again, setting aside things like dementia and things, which we'll assume this wasn't affecting him, setting aside that like as we age, we should all be smarter about life. We should all be better informed. We should have a bigger you know, I don't think it's ever appropriate to like turn to a 5-year-old and say, you know, what's your big perspective on life in the world? I mean, they're 5. They hardly know where their first grade is. But as we become 25 and 45 and 65 and even older, I sincerely hope I and others as we age get better at being people, that get better at understanding the world around us. And what is worrisome to me and maybe dispiriting to me is learning that there are people like you mentioned, and there are a lot of others who start idealistic and become cynical as they get to know the world better around them. I mean, why? That just sounds like bad. And I just don't know. That's not everybody's journey, but it's a common enough journey that it seems like something we should try to either fix, if not across society and ourselves. Do you agree with that point I'm making?
Yes, I do. And I think we can learn a lot from the people who maintain idealism fairly late into life. And they tend to be people that are really focused on relationships. They are not focused on, I would say, extrinsic markers of success. I'm always suspicious when somebody starts talking about, oh, we're riding this movement that's going to make all these changes, whatever the movement is, like we're getting better and we're riding this wave. We're in some new age of enlightenment or something like that. I think like that's just false. That's not how the world works. It's always cyclical. It's always up and down. It's not a one-way ticket towards progress. The people that don't attach themselves to these like grand visions of change, but they focus on like, I'm going to really invest in my kids. I'm going to invest in my community. I'm going to volunteer for these groups and as I move towards retirement, I'm going to figure out a way I can use my skills to help the community. These are people that you find them happy and they're fully engaged late in life, and they maintain a kind of idealism. It's not a youthful idealism, but it's an idealism based in experience and like grounded in the fact that as we invest more in relationships, we find it really rewarding and they pay off.
I think that's true. I guess the only question I have as a follow-up is, do you think for most people, doing all that makes them less cynical and more idealistic because they have these relationships that you describe? Or must first you sort of work on yourself? And once you sort of get yourself in that space, then you're able to go out and do those things? Or do those things sort of work in tandem? I mean, can you do all the stuff you describe without sort of getting that figured out in your own head first?
No, if you focus too much on your own head, you get stuck in the prison of your own mind. I mean,
so just go out and do stuff.
Go out and do stuff and work on relationships. I mean, this is the way in which you enlarge the soul, is you kind of extend the soul out into the world, out into other people, into parts of nature that are really where you have experiences of beauty. This is where you have growth. This is the only way in which to kind of redeem the self, is to extend it out. The more you focus inward and say, I just have to take care of myself before I can extend it out, you just keep shrinking.
Oh, and I think there's a lot of people who look at that the other way, who like, I think that's a problem.
It is a problem. I mean, because they are shrinking, they have these incredible shrinking lives.
Or they just feel like that until things are right with them, they can't possibly be part of a larger movement or organization or community.
And in the meantime, that community and the movement and everything just passes them by because they're standing, you know, waiting for something to come along. I mean, the only way to make meaningful change in your life is to set out on the journey. You have to move out. You have to move forward. And you might not know what direction you're going, but you have to start moving. And that's, I think it's the biggest problem that some people have, is that they want to wait and think they can get things figured out first or get themselves straight first. They're like, no, that's not how it works. You get yourself straight by extending yourself into what is good.
RingCentral will completely transform the way you work. It gives you built-in AI across all your business conversations. Your phone system has an AI receptionist that answers calls 24/7. Your video meetings have AI that takes notes instantly. Even your contact center has AI, so you can help customers faster. It all comes together in one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I have a question for you. I heard from you that you have been watching the Winter Olympics, which are still going on in Italy. Is that right?
Yes.
That shows you how closely I've been paying attention. My question for you is, when you're watching these, and I'll be curious maybe also which, assuming you can't possibly watch all of the Olympics, that's like impossible. So I'd be curious what sports or what things you're most interested in. But whenever you're watching, do you find yourself just naturally rooting for the Americans who are competing? And if so, why?
Not just naturally rooting for them, intentionally rooting for them in many cases, and rooting for Americans and rooting for the Americans who are closest to home.
Okay.
So Jordan Stoltz, who the speed skater, who's won 2 golds as of this recording, and has more competitions coming up. I mean, it's so fun to watch him. We're watching a generational talent for one thing. So like he's the fastest skater in the world right now, but he's also from Wisconsin. And the story of how he got started skating. I mean, he was inspired by Apollo Ono, who is a Olympic skater.
I do know who that is, kind of.
Right. Yeah, I saw him like when he was 3 years old or something and said, I want to be like that. And then his parents helped him to like, okay, we'll get you some skates. We'll help you skate, learn to skate, that sort of thing. I find, so this is a natural thing. As we learn more about people, we tend to cheer for them more. And that can be true of foreigners as well.
So, yeah, like I don't know this. I haven't been watching these sports, but I do know enough about speed skating that you're competing against others. And like, let's say in the one lane over from you is an Austrian. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that Austrian has like a great story probably about how he got hooked on this at a young age and how he, again, probably had supportive parents. Everybody who has got to the Olympics has some like inspirational angle. Yeah. But the one you're hearing about is the American because you're watching this presumably on NBC or their, you know, cornucopia of networks. And they're framing this up, you know, for the audience who they know is watching, people like you. And you learn more about Jordan. Is that his name?
Jordan Stoltz,
yeah. Than you do about the Austrian next door. I mean, I guess that's, but I mean, so is that, so the reason you root for Jordan and others who have who are Americans is because you know more about them I guess that's what you're saying?
Yeah. And I would have, like, if I knew more about the other skaters, the ones that I know more about, I'd probably root more for them. Sometimes you're watching something and you just find yourself, you're kind of, like, I'm just really hoping that this person wins, and you don't even realize that that's the case until you're watching them. Sofia Brignone, the Italian alpine skier who won the women's giant slalom, I think, the other day. Incredible story. And, like, I've been following her for a few years. I follow alpine skiing more than anything.
And you ski sometime. You've not been in the Olympics, I don't believe. But
I've skied, yeah, you ski my whole life pretty
yeah,
much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've been following a lot of these skiers and so there's some foreign skiers I really like, but then there's American skiers because I've been following them a little more closely. I'm really cheering for them. So Michaela Schifrin, I really hope she wins the women's slalom because she's probably the best women's skier in history. And yet she has not done well at the Olympics. She had a horrific crash the last time, and she's had an amazing recovery. So cheering for people like that. But there's another reason also for, I think, as Americans, I mean, we find ourselves cheering for Americans, I think, because we know them better, but I think we ought to. And that is because the Olympics are really significant achievements. And as Americans, we want to know that we have a country that is capable of supporting young athletes and helping them to develop to their potential. Now, we hope that doesn't happen just in sports. It shouldn't happen in sports. But sports are like a good kind of visible marker of how well our society supports young people in developing their talents in general. And so if we can't produce good athletes, that means we're not supporting people and helping them develop. So what's going on? We're dysfunctional in some respect. When I see somebody, for example, I'll give another, Jesse Diggins, who's the cross-country skier from Minnesota, who has been the most successful American cross-country skier ever. She represents an achievement that for our Nordic skiing programs that will help them develop, help inspire more people, but also mean there's more investment in them, there's more support for them, people will know what they're doing, and I think that's good. I think we want to have the kind of society in which we're committed to developing excellence in some categories.
As listeners on this show probably know, the only sport I follow closely is Major League Baseball. And specifically, I'm a Minnesota Twins fan. And if anybody follows Major League Baseball, they'll know the Minnesota Twins have not made it to the World Series in many years. In fact, the last time was 1991.
And they have a dysfunctional organization, and well, that's largely why. I mean,
well,
they haven't been very, like,
sure,
right?
Sure. But even though since 1991, the Twins have not been in the World Series, I try to watch the World Series every year. And people will often say, who are you rooting for? And because my team's not in there, my response is, I just hope for a good series. And that's, like, true. And I think, you know, this last World Series between the Dodgers and the Blue Jays could not have been more interesting. It was maybe one of the best World Series in the history of the sport. And I think people look at me like either like they don't believe me when I say that, or feel like that's weird, but I don't find anything strange about, like, watching a competition, whether it's downhill skiing or Major League Baseball, and, like, just watching it without feeling the need to root for a particular team or a particular person. But that's, like, not how most people watch sports. Why do you think we do need sort of that reason to root?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there's a natural feeling, a kind of identification with others, and then we feel good when the person that we kind of identify with wins. But I find myself in cases where I don't know a lot about the sport, and in which,
insert curling joke here.
Well, like curling, I've been really cheering for Americans. I like curling. That's one of the sports I've been following.
And you like know the rules and everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So like that I said. Okay.
But figure skating.
Okay.
I don't know the rules. I don't understand it. I watch something, and it turns out the judges, like, discounted them because the ankle turned in instead of out on one of the turns, you know, and then they end up getting second place instead of first place or something. I think, oh, like, what the heck? I don't know what this is. And I really don't. I don't cheer for the Americans more than others in that kind of sport. Most of the sports in which it comes to judges, like giving scores, and this applies to, like, a lot of the slope style events.
Or like gymnastics, of course, in the summer games.
Gymnastics in the summer games. But a lot of, like, the snowboarding events where they're doing the jumps and the half pipe and things like that. I don't really cheer for the Americans more than any other team. Like, it's kind of cool. They're doing flips and things.
It's a spectacle.
But it's a spectacle. I'm more invested where there's an actual score that comes from, like the performance, and the audience
skating. You can tell who the winner is.
Yeah, like they're actually timed. So those, like the, when I watch the half pipe or figure skating or something, and I watch it a little bit, I'm not enthusiastic. I just want to see something cool, you know, and I don't care who does it, right? But it's just like really cool jumps or something like that. That's great. But when it comes to speed skating, I want Jordan Stoltz to win every competition he's in.
One thing I'll mention before we close, and I've read one story about the Winter Games this round, and it was something that a story the New York Times had, and the headline really caught my eye because I found it was interesting. It was basically looking at what past medal winners have done with their medals, like where they keep them, like how, you know, and it was fascinating to me to read this story, and I think it wasn't Michael Phelps. I know he's the most honored swimmer ever, but whoever is number two, and I forget the gentleman's name. Maybe you know.
Eric Heiden, the speed skater.
No. This was
in swimming.
Just in swimming. So I don't know who it was, but some guy.
I'm thinking about Winter Olympics.
You are right stuck now. On the winner, right? And they interviewed this guy, and he's kind of done with the Olympics now, but won a bunch of medals, many gold medals, and he's like. Yeah, I think a lot of people had them in their sock drawer was kind of a thing, or their nightstand, and he said, and this was kind of a refrain throughout the Time story is, you know, it's great when you win, it's absolutely invigorating, but then when you look back on it, it's much more about the journey and how you got there than it is this piece of metal on a ribbon, and so that's why for a lot of these people, they just. I mean, they're not going to like put it on eBay probably, but like the actual piece of hardware is sort of like not that important to them. And are you surprised to hear that, or does that make sense to you?
Makes complete sense. I mean, that's what you find that with everything in life. People that don't complete the journey often like hang on to regrets about not reaching the destination.
What would have happened if I would have done one thing different?
Yeah. But the people who reach the destination, then they look back and say, oh, yeah, I got there. And then it all kind of ended. I was done. And it was really fulfilling for about 24 hours. And then I'm thinking, well, what comes next? Because you still have life to live. And then you realize, like, well, it's what's been great is the whole journey towards this. And that's why some people want to continue it. And repeat it. It's not because they want to be recognized again. It's they want to extend that journey, right?
Or go through it again.
I mean, I think this is what led Lindsey Vonn to make the comeback. I mean, and she had that tragic accident, and her skiing career is over now. But like, why does she come back when she's in her 40s? Like, she loves skiing. She loves the competition. That's the part of it that she wanted to continue. And good for them, but it makes complete sense. And I think that's true of just about everything in life.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And assuming Rick writes one this week and figures out what he wants to say, you can read his column about idealism and many of the topics we talked about today. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.